pop it, pump it, jack it up, and by the turn I'm in the muck. The river lingers so far away. It's hard to run a bluff, and robbing blinds is getting tough. Still, I got bills to pay. I raise the river, then fold for one more bet. They look at me as if I'm from Mars. I don't mind walking a rope without a net, but I could do without these damn scars. I cut myself on the razor's edge. My chips are bleeding away. I cut myself on the razor's edge. My mirror stares back in dismay.
Hello and welcome to the Thinking Poker Podcast, episode 26. I'm Andrew Brokus, and with me is Nate Mavis.
How are you doing today, Andrew?
I'm lovely. How are you?
I'm doing great. Doing great. Coming to you from Somerville, Massachusetts, as always.
One thing that I'm excited about, I am still in the World Rec.Gambling Poker Tournament. Are you familiar?
I am. I played 1 year, and I would have played this year if I had remembered to, and I'm going to play next year. And you are down into the top 100, is that right?
Yeah, there are 82 players remaining now. They're starting to drop pretty quickly. The blinds are huge. For those who don't know, this was most likely the first poker tournament. Well, I guess there was some poker played via IRC. Does that sound right, Nate? I think
yes.
So maybe not the first poker tournament ever played online, but certainly among the first. I think, you know, I'm sure that it predates any actual online poker site that exists. And it was organized by members of the rec.gambling.poker Usenet group, which if you've listened to our Lee Jones episode, there was some discussion on there. So they organized this play-by-email tournament. There's no money at stake. I think over 1,000 people entered this year. And you know, all that happens, basically what you would expect it to be, you get emailed a hand, and there's a server that can understand basic commands. So you can email back that you want to raise to a certain amount, or bet a certain amount, or fold. And you can also pre-program responses. So you can say, if the pot is unraised, when it gets to me, then raise, otherwise fold, that sort of thing. And obviously, it's not structured very well. You don't get to play terribly many hands before the blinds go up. We started pretty deep, but I survived my first all-in recently. We just got inside of 100 players. For the first time, I got it all in. It was 10-8 suited against ace-9 offsuit, and I managed to suck out there. And then the very next hand, they had a raise and a call. I jammed with ace-queen offsuit from the big blind and got no calls. So I'm back into comfortable territory now with 20-ish big blinds and fewer than 100 people remaining in the tournament. So I think this could be my year.
Well done. Good luck. It's the best $0 you'll ever win if you win the tournament. So that's...
And the longest poker tournament I've ever played. It started in October, and now here we are, nearly April, and still a decent amount of poker to be played.
You get a day to act on your hand, right?
You have, I think it's either 6 or 8 hours, but the way it works is that you establish certain, you have to pick 8 hours out of any given day when you are active. And so you get, I think you get 6 active hours to respond. So what that means is that I can say that I'm going to be active between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m., which I think is what many people do, because that's when they're at their computers during work. So they say, I'm going to be active during these hours. And if it comes to be your turn at 2 p.m., then you have until 9 a.m. the next day, and then 3 more hours. So you have until noon the next day, at which point 6 of your active hours have expired, and then your hand is folded if you still haven't acted by then, and you get reminders telling you that it's still your turn.
Very good, very good. Is Matt Nitro still alive? Do you know?
I don't know. I have no idea who else is still in the tournament.
I see.
Other than people at my table, none of whom have recognizable names. They encourage you to use your real name when you played, which I did, and I have yet to encounter another person who has done that.
It's probably the most loving memoir of WRGPT. Is that
That's
right?
The one, yeah.
Yeah, it was from Matt Matros in his book, The Making of a Poker Player, which is an above average poker memoir written by a way above average human being. So, and I root for him every year on this thing. So he's got enough bracelets. What he really needs is another $0 crown, I think.
I wouldn't mind getting heads up with Mitras.
Yeah, he's a What a great guy. What a great guy.
So hopefully I can keep you posted on this. We seem to be playing roughly a hand a day. People are just complaining that this table's been moving a little slowly, but I'd say I've been averaging close to a hand a day. So hopefully I'll still be in the tournament to update you next week on my progress.
Good luck with that. They say it's a good learning tool. You get to call your best poker friends and talk about them or think it over all day if you want. And people say they learn a lot that way.
Yeah.
So, but good luck. And maybe we should also talk about a hand that was played for actual dollars, or at least tournament chips with actual money on the line.
Yeah, well, let's remind people first that our strategy segment is presented by Tournament Poker Edge, where in addition to my videos, you can find a lot of cool hand history reviews. I think we talked last week about some of the hand history reviews that are available, and those were reviews that had gone up recently. But one thing that I've done on the site this week is they have a way that you can go through and you can look at the 15 most popular videos of all time, which Bragg, one of mine, has cracked the top 15. So thanks to everyone who upvoted that. So I was looking back through, and there's a hand history review of Go Leafs Go A, Mike Leah, when he chopped the W Coop main event five ways and got like over $500,000 for that. So he's doing a hand by hand review. He has already done, but I am just beginning to watch a hand by hand review of the entire W Coop, which is pretty awesome. I'm a big Mike Leah fan. I played with him, I think, in the main event of the WSOP a few years ago, but I had already recognized him from online. And of course, he's gone on to have tremendous success online. He was already a well known player at that time. So I'm really enjoying that. So there's a lot of cool older videos on there as well. I've mostly been telling you about the recent stuff that's come out, but I'm just starting to explore the treasure trove that is the TPE archive.
I imagine that the probability that somebody listens to this podcast, given that his screen name is Go Leafs Go A, is probably pretty high. We're in Canada.
Approximately 75% of the Canadian poker playing population listens to the podcast, I think.
Yeah, there's an annual tournament series in British Columbia, right? Like, I think that tournament series is going to be a lot tougher this year. I mean, I flatter myself, but I feel like a lot of people in Canada are really working on their games.
No, I played that, the British Columbia Poker Championship. I played that in 2011 when I was in Vancouver. It was a fun tournament. It was nice. It was a good. I think it was like a $3,000 Canadian buy-in, so it's like a real nice buy-in level, a decent money at stake, but still attracting a wide variety of people to play. There were people who came from all over Canada to play it, but obviously there's a pretty strong local following at the sure. casino there as well.
There's a lot of money in Vancouver too, right? A lot of people who can afford a $3,000 virtual poker tournament, probably.
Yeah. Isn't it? Yeah, it was well structured. It was 3 days, and I think I ended up bubbling the final table. I got like 13th or something, but it was nice. It was one of the more fun poker tournaments I've had.
Sounds good. Possible future Thinking Poker podcast meetup.
Yeah.
after we're done, what? Registering the main event with satellite winners, making AeroPress coffee, following Ed Miller around town and check raising him on the river. Then after that, British Columbia Poker Championships. It's some kind of podcast bucket list.
So our hand tonight comes to us from Sylvain, who, as you might guess from the name, is French. We can probably even skip the analysis and just assume that he played the hand spewy and over-aggressive.
I mean, some people, if you interact with us on Twitter, you maybe already know a little bit about Sylvain.
I believe, Nate, you described this hand, I liked your description of it, as it's more about a situation than a particular hand. So I'm going to try to give you a little bit of a build up to it first. This was in a preliminary WSOP event. I believe it was a $1,500 6-max tournament. Sylvain says that the table was not easy, as it would be expected to be early in the series in a 6-max tournament, but it was also not impossible to navigate. And he had run his stack up to 14K by the third level when Justin Bonomo is brought to his table and lands two seats to Sylvain's left. So at that point, of course, the table is getting quite a bit more difficult. Sylvain says that there's five other professionals, he is not a professional. There are five professionals at the table. Sylvain is a serious poker player, but not a professional. And his intention is to tighten up at and I guess hope to survive to a better table or just wait for good hands, which I think is a pretty decent plan at a tough table, especially if the tournament is well enough structured that it's feasible to survive the day, which it may not be in a six max tournament if you're only at level three in a WSOP prelim.
Yeah, it might not be, but I mean, there are different degrees of shutting it down. You can also just tighten up a bit, and even doing that is enough to keep you out of a lot of the toughest spots. I mean, especially if you're not deep enough to worry, if you're not deep enough to like easily make it to the end of the day without losing too much of your stack, then you're also not deep enough to really worry about going broke with an overpair or a top pair or something like
Yeah, that's
that.
a good point.
If the table's so aggressive that you're thinking about shutting it down anyway.
And that's the other nice thing of being at a, especially a tough six max table. It probably will be really aggressive, which means that, I mean, it'll still take a little bit of luck for you to pick up big hands, but it's pretty likely that even if you're playing tight and even if everyone folds with the, when you do like cold four bet, there's a decent chance you will get the chance to cold four bet when you pick up like pocket queens or something. So, and at which point, even if everyone does fold, you're still going to win a decent amount of money. So there's, if people are just constantly putting a lot of money into the pot, it can be a viable just shut it down and wait for decent hands as long as you know how to moderate what counts as a decent hand. Waiting for ace king plus and queens plus might be a little excessive, but if you're capable of kind of acknowledging people's ranges and recognizing when like ace jack is a good enough hand, then yeah, I think it's a pretty feasible strategy.
Just because you're tightening up doesn't mean you aren't bluffing ever. Like, I understand that you don't want to do a lot of pre-flop worrying, but if you haven't raised in half an hour, just go ahead and three bet somebody just whenever it seems okay. I mean, it's still going to be profitable. I mean, you're going to do it less than you ought to be doing it, maybe, but that doesn't mean you have to never do it. I mean, you know, Zeus is not going to descend from the heaven and cut your hand off, you know? Like, if you're tightening up and waiting for something good, you know, then the guy on the button raises. It just three bet every now and then from the small blind. Just trust me, it'll work out over the long run. Like, it's.
Unfortunately, Sylvain's plan of shutting it down quickly goes out the window when he notices that Justin is running over the table, and he decides it's only fair if he gives him a bit of resistance. So then we get a sequence of hands. One, Justin opens under the gun to 350. Sylvain three bets with king queen off from the small blind. Justin asks if he's covered, and when Sylvain says that he does not have Justin covered, Justin moves all in, and Sylvain folds the king queen. So that's the first of their battles. In the second one, Justin opens under the gun to 350. Sylvain three bets to 925 from the small blind, and Justin folds. These are at 75, 150, by the way.
How do you feel about these hands? If the plan was to shut it down, but then you can't let Justin run over the table, I'm gonna three bet under the gun raises with king queen from the small blind and ace queen from the small blind. How do you feel about that?
The ace queen, I think, is trivial. The king queen, I still like the three bet. I might go for a slightly larger. In fact, I think I would probably want to go for a slightly larger size, maybe like 1050 instead of 950 in both cases. Yeah, I think he probably ought to be three betting both of those. If Justin's range is as wide as he leads us to believe, I would like to three bet rather than call out of the small blind when I have a hand that's pretty well ahead of his range, even if it's not going to be in great shape against his calling range. I think the fact that we're going to be out of position, that Sylvain is acknowledging Justin is a superior player here, I think there's a premium to be put on winning the pot pre-flop when it's close.
That sounds good. I'm not sure. I'm a little bit worried about Sylvain's justification, which is that he says, I really didn't like the idea of playing king queen out of position, so I either take it down pre-flop or fold to the four bet. If you're so scared of playing a three bet pot, then I start to wonder if just calling isn't better. It sounds like he's trying to fight fire with fire when there's ample water available. If you know, king queen flops a lot of good hands that you can merrily get all in with after the flop. Like, if you're going to check fold too much or lose your mind and move all in too much after the flop, if Justin flats you, then I start to think that calling is better. I agree that ace queen needs to be three bet in this spot. I wonder if, given everything that's going on, just calling with king queen isn't a better play than three betting.
I think that he's saying he's more concerned about playing king queen out of position in a single raised pot, which I mean, we can debate whether or not he ought to be more concerned about that, but I think that I mean, it will be trickier to the point where if he just flats, there's going to be less than 1K in the pot. He says he has 8K or so in his stack. I think that that might actually lead to some trickier spots with King Queen, where it's going to be a little tougher for him to play top pair, open ended, straight draw types of hands with that stack size than it is if he three bets and call, and gets called. There's going to be better than 2K in the pot, and there's going to be like 7K behind. I think that's a much easier spot to play when he flops top pair or an open ended straight draw.
That's fair. That's fair. I'm convinced.
So we got those two histories, one where he three bets from the small blind and folds to a shove, another where Sylvain three bets from the small blind and wins the pot. Blinds are still 75-150, and now Sylvain and Justin both have 14K, so it sounds like Sylvain has won a pot from someone else in the meantime. Folds to Sylvain on the button, and he opens up to 300. The one bit of information we don't have here is how active Sylvain has been in terms of opening pots. It sounds like he's got a little bit of history of three betting Justin. We don't know how much he's been opening raising. If Justin has been real active, he may have not have had a ton of opportunities to open raise. Although Justin's only two suits to his left, so he should have had some. But it would be interesting to know just how aggressive he perceived to be. But he opens on the button with King Chag off to 300, and Justin three bets out of the big blind to 950. Sylvain says that he thinks Justin's three-betting range is very wide. Does that sound right to you?
I think Sylvain would know better than I would, but I wouldn't doubt it.
Yeah, I think, probably, even if Sylvain is perceived as being a bit tight, I think there is also a perception, when it comes to button raises, sometimes there's even an expectation that a guy who has not played very many hands is looking for an opportunity to play a hand, and yeah, when it's folded to him on the button, especially if it hasn't been for a long time, the fact that he's been playing tight for the last half hour or hour, whatever, especially when he has shown some aggressive proclivity, like if he has not opened very many pots but he has three bet a couple of times, I think would be reasonable to interpret that he might still have a pretty wide button opening range. And I could see Justin wanting to three bet with a variety of stuff, especially if he also perceives that this player might be a little intimidated by him. He may be thinking he can win quite often, either pre-flop or with a c-bet, and find that three betting is going to be better for him than flatting with the relatively wide range I expect he'd want to play to a button min-raise.
Yeah, I mean, especially when I think about World Series situations, in Justin's spot, this is exactly the kind of thing I'm looking for with that kind of image in Sylvain's seat, just because they're going to fold a fair amount of the time pre-flop, but the psychological factors that come into play in the World Series often make people call pre-flop, fold the flop very often, which is just, I mean, they might as well just hand you their wallet. It's just a money machine for you. So
yeah,
I think I definitely agree. I think sometimes I even want to re-raise people more when they're somewhat tighter than average, and I feel like it's that kind of obligatory button raise, or even a non-obligatory button raise. Like, if I think they have ace 10 or something, and this happens fairly often, you can just get a sense that somebody is raising with a hand roughly like that. Oftentimes the best play is, you know, you can just call and take a flop and have a good idea what's in their hand, but also like re-raising and letting them fold the flop incorrectly a lot of the time is even a bigger money machine than calling and playing flop in a single raise pot is.
And here's an interesting twist that comes to us via my inability to read correctly. Sylvain does actually say in the next line, he's seen me be pretty aggressive even against other players at the table. So he could really do this with lots of different things. Interesting conversation there, but it sounds like, in fact, Sylvain did have a kind of aggressive image even outside of three-betting Justin, which I think makes it even more clear that Justin probably is three-betting him pretty wide.
You know, it's funny. We read these hands before we bring them on the air. Like, I know I think about them, but, man, we just both completely missed it. Yeah, well, somehow we're, like, extremely not results-oriented when we analyze hands. We don't even remember what people write in the emails. That's how not results-oriented we are. So,
yeah, speaking of which, I'm pretty confident that I posted this hand on my blog shortly after it happened, which was during, I think, the 2012 series. And I deliberately did not go back and look at it. So it'll be interesting to see whether my analysis now contradicts whatever I said about the hand in the blog. Now, I think this is where the hand gets most interesting. So Sylvain has opened to 300 on the button. Justin has 3-bet to 950 out of the big blind. And Sylvain decides to 4-bet to 2025. And effective stacks here again are 14K. And apparently both Justin and Sylvain have approximately 14K. So neither one is. It's not like one guy has 40K or something.
I prefer calling here. I see reasons for a 4-bet, but I think King Jack plays really well given these reads against Justin. You have a strong high card hand, you have a king in your hand, and you have a jack in your hand, and you have position. That sounds great to me. You'll be able to continue on a lot of flops. You'll be able to proceed with confidence with most of the time you have a pair. And I also think that Justin is really good at reading hands, really good at reading situations, and really fearless. He's going to win the four betting, five betting game. I would rather four bet with more obvious value hands that I want to call five bets with, and with more obvious air hands. I realize that gives up a little bit to a player like Justin, but I'm willing to give up a little bit and just play a somewhat more polarized range than is optimal. Then I feel like that's a way that I lose less to a world-class player like Justin. So I see the reasons to four bet King Jack, but I would prefer, if Sylvain is not a mega expert, just calling the three bet.
My guess is that some people listening are wondering why you say King Jack offsuit is a good hand to play in a three bet pot. They're thinking it sounds like a trouble hand. If I flop top pair, my kicker's not going to be that good. I could be up against ace king, aces, kings, queens, jacks, ace jack. Don't I need to be worried about those things? Is it really such a good idea to call with King Jack planning to play one pair? Like, it's the nuts.
Yeah, I mean, often those are worries with King Jack, but here we've just gone through all the reasons, both from a empirical standpoint and from a theoretical standpoint, why we expect Justin's range to be wide here. And I think that you should not be worried about kicker trouble if you flop a king or if you flop a jack. I mean, if it comes down ace, queen, jack, then you have to start thinking about your equity in a different way. But if it comes down king, deuce, deuce, I would not think that you have kicker trouble. If it comes down, you know, jack 7-3, I would not think that you have kicker trouble. And if it comes down 10-9 deuce, I also think you should be often have your foot on the gas.
It's not that you're never outkicked. I mean, he does legitimately have those hands. If you get a jack 5 deuce flop, you are going to stack off to ace, jack, queens, kings, and aces. That is going to happen.
Yeah.
The reason you're not worried about it is that if Justin's range is as wide as we suspect that it is, Justin's range also includes a number of jacks that you dominate. So his range is also going to include queen, jack, jack 10, jack 9, maybe jack 8. If you're talking about calling an under-the-gun raise at a full ring table, yeah, King Jack offsuit is not a hand that performs very well, and it's not a situation where you're going to end up playing top pair strongly, because you expect that that player probably has a pretty strong range that's weighted towards hands that really dominate you. When you flop your top pair, you still can't treat it as the best hand, because they're not likely to make those second best hands. Most people are folding Jack 10 offsuit, Queen Jack offsuit under the gun, and that makes your King Jack offsuit not worth that much. Here, we're looking at an aggressive player three betting out of the big blind against a button raise. And there's good reason to think that he will do that with jacks that you dominate, with kings that you dominate. And also that sometimes, especially on the king high flop, he'll try to represent that king even when he doesn't have it. You know, he'll want to represent that he has ace king. And so you can get implied odds from both of those scenarios. You can get implied odds from the times that you legitimately cooler him and you flop top pair with a better kicker than his. And you can also get implied odds from the times that he flops a draw or even less than that and decides that he's going to represent top pair when you in fact have top pair. There's even possibility for you to flop dominating draws. As you mentioned, Nate, like a 10-9x flop. If he has queen jack and you have king jack, even though in some sense you just have a gut shot, you can put your money in as a pretty good favorite in that circumstance.
Yes.
Likewise, a queen 10x flop, you might be up against like jack 9 when you have king jack. And again, you're going to put your money in as a really big favorite. So you don't want to look at this hand. You don't want to think only in terms of worst case scenarios. When you think about the player's entire range, you can see that your hand actually will play pretty well post flop, which isn't to say that you'll always know where you stand compared to the hand that Justin has this time. But I think you'll know where you stand compared to his range, which is that you can expect to be in good shape most of the time when you flop top pair or a strong draw.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I mean, if you're still skeptical, this is a great time to go to Poker Stove and put King Jack on one side and play with ranges on the other side. And I bet, especially if you think about the good things that'll happen with position, you will be surprised at how good a hand King Jack is to have here.
Poker Stove seems not to be online at the moment, actually.
Oh no, or whatever poker stove thing. I've got something on my iPad that could.
Yeah, there's a ton of programs like it, but I went to recommend it to one of my students the other day, and I was going to give them a link, and their website is down. I heard some rumors that they just weren't getting as many donations as they needed to keep the site running, or I don't know what their reasons were, but it's down at the moment. But yeah, there are a number of poker stove equivalents. You can just Google poker equity calculator. I don't know enough about any of them to recommend one over the other, really. But
go to twodimes.net. You remember twodimes.net?
Oh, yeah, that's a good site. Yeah, that's a good recommendation.
Man, I'm so old. There's no, not even any poker stove anymore. Oh, man.
It's the end of an era.
Yeah, it's yeah. And the great thing about twodimes.net is that for old men like me, we can get our stud equities there also. And yeah, they got all kinds of games. So
in Sylvain's defense, he says that his reason for wanting to four bet the king jack is that he believes he has blockers to some of Justin's jamming range, which I think is true. I mean, king jack offsuit will, if for that reason, it'll have better blocker value than trying to four bet with a hand like 8-5 offsuit. 8-5 offsuit might still be a better four betting candidate if you think Justin is rarely going to call the four bet. You know, if Justin's just always going to shove or fold, then king jack gives you a couple of blockers, meaning he's going to shove a little less often. With, you know, he's going to have ace king or kings or jacks or ace jack less often when you have a king and a jack in your hand. But there's value in calling with king jack, as we just went over, whereas there's not value in calling with 8-5 offsuit. And you lose that value in calling when you choose to four bet king jack. Whereas with an, like Nate was suggesting, a polarized range, when you four bet with a really weak hand, you don't, like, your other alternative was folding, which is an EV of zero. So if you believe that the four bet is plus EV, then you're just comparing that to zero. Versus here, there's some EV in calling, which is X. And even if you think four betting is more profitable than calling, it's not, you know, it's not as much more profitable than it would be with a hand that you were otherwise going to fold.
Yeah, that's the thing. If you're going to put some blocker hands into your four betting range, put ace deuce into that range, and you know, pick a hand with an ace in it that you don't want to play, and then play king jack, which will play well after the flop.
So then four bets to 2025, and he says he's obviously ready to fold to a five bet. Justin ends up calling the 2025. What do we make of that?
If this happened to me, I would think Justin knows what's going on and he has a good idea of my range. And I think if he had, I mean, so what would Justin do with his worst hands? He would probably fold, correctly recognizing that Sylvain's range, if not, I mean, not nutted, but probably isn't enough to make a move with 7-4 suited or anything like that. I doubt he's running crazy bluffs like this. With the very top of Justin's range, probably he would just re-raise and expect Sylvain to feel priced in with enough of his four betting range. He would also probably fear losing action if he just called, so I imagine he would five bet most, if not all the time, with the top of his range.
I would definitely not expect all the time. I think this is a pretty decent spot to just call with a big hand.
Yeah, interesting. I wasn't so sure about that when I said it, so I'm glad to have my skepticism.
Yeah, I mean, if he believes that Sylvain is on the wide side when he four bets, then a jam is not going to get that much action. I would actually think he'd be more likely to jam like ace queen, ace king, like those kinds of hands that are probably ahead, but that can be tricky to play post flop out of position. I would think he'd be more likely to jam those. And I'm not going to say that he's never going to four bet, especially the hands that can flop kind of badly. Like I think he might actually be more likely to four bet like jacks or queens rather than aces. This does strike me as a pretty big, a pretty good spot. If he thinks that Sylvain is on the wide side, then, you know, jamming aces, he's just going to get a fold a lot of the time. I don't think there's really room to five bet and expect that you're going to induce anything crazy. It's not entirely impossible, as I mentioned. Sylvain is French, but
Does Justin know that his opponent is French? This is important.
I would say Sylvain. Well, I'll say a couple of things. One. For other French listeners, this is kind of a shtick that I have with Sylvain. It's not really meant to. I don't actually despise French players. the second, Sylvain has a noticeable accent, but he has lived in the United States for some time, so I don't know how much he's been speaking at the table. He has been known to have a slightly Eurotrash style in terms of how he dresses, so. I would say that there's a decent chance Sylvain has guessed, or that Justin has guessed that Sylvain is European, but he may or may not have determined that he is specifically French.
Don't worry, guys. We're just making fun of Sylvain. We're not making fun of all the French people. We're directing all the French insults only at Sylvain. Don't, no, no worries. That makes it not offensive at all, right?
Yeah, so I mean, I think he may well be thinking that he can at least pick up a continuation bet by check shoving the flop with aces, and that he also may get Sylvain to like flop a pair or a draw with a number of hands that would just fold pre-flop to a jam. So I wouldn't say that he's never gonna five bet those hands, but I think he'll probably be. I'd say he's probably doing some of both with the bigger hands.
Okay. Yeah, so good.
And then I do think that he's going to be flatting a lot of medium strength hands that aren't good enough to jam preflop, which this is actually one of the other problems with four betting king jack. You know, we talked about how well you can play top pair when you just call, because there are going to be hands like jack eight, jack nine in your opponent's range. I think those hands are probably folding to the four bet, jack eight and jack nine. Jack 10 suited, queen jack suited might be calling, but the offsuit ones are probably folding. So now, I mean, you're still going to be going with top pair in a four bet pot, just because at this point the pot is going to be, it's going to be like a 2-to-1 stack to pot ratio. So it's not really going to be room for you to get away from top pair, I don't think. But I think you're not going to core Justin nearly as often in a four bet pot as you are in a three bet pot. He's folding a lot of the hands that you dominate. And the stuff that he is calling with is, it's going to be a lot of medium strength hands that still doesn't have you in great shape. It might be ace jack, ace 10. I guess king jack will be in there as well. The medium pocket pairs where you're really only like a coin flip against those hands, some suited connector kind of stuff where there's a few of those that you dominate, but for the most part, you're not a huge favorite against suited connectors, and they're not going to put money in. There's not a lot of post-flop scenarios where they put money in real bad against you. That's the kind of stuff I'd expect him to be calling with here, along with the occasional slow-played monster.
Yeah, I think that's right.
All right, so we got Justin flat to the 4-bet. There's 4,200 in the pot. Should be 4,200 in the pot to see the flop, which means 12K still in the effective stacks. So 3-to-1 stack to pot ratio, not 2-to-1 as I predicted earlier. The flop comes jack 10-7 and Justin checks. Do you see any merit in slow playing here?
No, I don't. I really.
This is a dream scenario, because I think there's a lot of draws that Justin's going to be willing to put it in with on this board. I mean, it's certainly not a guarantee that you're good, right? You could be against jack 10 or 9-8. But I also think like 10-9, 10-8, 8-7 suited, maybe even like 9-7 suited, jack 9 suited, king queen, all those hands are going to be in his range as well. So I think this is actually a board where you can expect to get it in with pretty good equity. And although I was saying there is a chance that he slow played some bigger hands, he is also 4-betting a lot of the hands that dominate you, or 5-betting a lot of the hands that dominate you a decent amount of the time. So I'm going to feel real good about the hand here, but it's not a case where you want to see more cards.
Yeah, and I think I would bet somewhat bigger. I bet like 65% of the pot, I think, and continue against a raise. You know, I mean, there won't be much left to do other than jam against a raise, but
you're not betting like 2,500 or so into a pot of 4K?
2,650, I would bet, probably.
Sylvain bet 36,25, which I think is a little big. He says that it's because of the flop texture, and I do agree that generally on more coordinated boards, you want to bet larger when you see bet, and you want to see bet a little less often. But the fact that it's a 4-bet pot and that it's the stack to pot ratio is low is a reason to see bet smaller. I think it's pretty often Justin is going to be raising or folding here rather than calling. And as I just kind of went through all those draws, I think he's probably jamming most of those draws rather than just calling you with them. So I don't think you have to be super concerned about the pot odds that you're offering. I mean, you want to bet enough that there's room for him to jam. You want to bet an amount that can induce a jam, but I don't think you want to bet more than you have to put him into shove or fold mode. And I think you're right that like 2650 is about enough to get him into that mode where he's mostly going to raise and commit to the pot or not. You're betting 3,600, I think, looks a little too strong. He's probably not expecting you to fold that often after betting such a large chunk of your remaining stack. I mean, that's like 25% of your remaining stack.
Yeah, I really worry that Sylvain turned his hand face up here, or at least he gave away way too much information about his range. I think that Justin can reliably take the very weakest part and some of the very strongest part out of Sylvain's range here. And even beyond the fact that Sylvain didn't check, I think Justin gets more information than he's entitled to. And when you're playing against world-class players, you just can't get cute with your bet sizing. They're world-class because they will own you if you do that. And I think this is a pretty poor mistake. I think I don't really like the four bet either, but this is probably the biggest mistake of the hand. The pot is big. He leaked information in a big way when the pot was very big. And that's about the worst thing you can do in a poker game against a world-class player. So I don't like this. I think he should bet less. Unless I'm wrong that he would have done that with his whole betting range, in which case, you know, that's fine. But I think it's still wrong for other reasons.
Right. It's better if he's doing it with his whole betting range, but I still think betting a smaller amount with his whole betting range is better.
Yeah, it's not a catastrophe if he's doing it with his own. It's merely poor if he's doing it with his whole betting range, but it's not a catastrophe. If he's not, then it's a catastrophe.
Yeah. I'm starting to feel bad. We're really giving Sylvain a hard time here.
The ace-queen, he played the ace-queen well. King-queen, he probably played well. He raised correctly. There are good reasons for four betting. I think this is instructive. You can do a lot right, but if you, in the heat of the moment, and a lot of this is a planning issue, you know, you gotta think through the hand ahead. And I'm sure Sylvain was planning a lot and thinking a lot, but it's a good example of how there's a lot of money left to be made at poker. It's, you know, a smart guy and a strong player looks at a flop and he says, oh, I have to bet more. And it's not that he's trying to have an unbalanced range, but he probably wouldn't have had that thought with air, you know? So that's how he cuts his range into more parts than it ought to be cut into. You know, you just don't have to be a bad player or a stupid person to make a mistake like that, which is actually a catastrophe, I think it's really bad. And I think a lot of people don't realize how bad it is. On the flip side, this is how you make money at poker, and especially in high stakes, high stress situations. There are mistakes like this all over the place in poker tournaments. And if you want to know why, despite all the wailing and gnashing of teeth over the games being unbeatable, if you want to know why you still see good players winning a ton of money very often. Situations like this, I think, are a big part of why.
So Justin jams, and of course Sylvain calls. Justin ends up showing up with ace-10, and Sylvain is, I'm sure, very happy both to double up and to eliminate Justin from the table in the tournament. I would consider this just about the, to paraphrase a Tommy Angelo-ism, the worst hand never fold. I actually think, like, I kind of doubt that Justin is showing up with much King-10 or Queen-10. But I don't know that I would really want to get it in with those hands anyway, given the size of Sylvain's bet and what we were saying about it. 10-9 is a different story because then you've got the gut shot going along with the hand as well. I think I'd actually rather get it in with 10-9 than Queen-10 here. I think that Ace-10 might be one of the worst hands I want to put my money in. Equity-wise, not necessarily in terms of where it ranks on the Hoyle's list of hand rankings, but equity-wise, I think Ace-10 might be one of the hands that's going to have lowest equity against Sylvain's calling range that I'm still willing to put the money in with.
I feel bad. I want to say things like, man, Sylvain just straight up coolered him and got so lucky. But yeah, I think, yeah, I how about this? I don't think the results contradict anything we said, the flop bet size, which I think is the biggest thing I want to say about this hand.
All right, well, merci Sylvain pour le main.
Fuck a flush when it's no good. I'm laying down when I should. Yeah, I'm running good. I'm holding up and sucking out. Turn up the heat, cause I can't be beat when I'm running good. I'm a stacking and a racking and a coloring it up again. Yeah, I'm a smoking and a choking and the dealer is my best.
It's Tommy Angelo time on the book club. We are reading Elements of Poker. For today, we're looking at part one of the book, which is probably rustling into the microphone here. It's entitled Universal Elements, running through page 84. And in my judgment, it's impractical to try to summarize this entire section. So personally, I think it makes more sense just to, Nate, for you and I to talk about some parts that we liked or that we had additional thoughts on, and not necessarily try to say the way we did with Ed's book, here's a run-through of what happened in this chapter. I think there's simply too much going on, and so much of what Tommy's saying is the way he says it is a big part of what's great about it. So I feel like we'd really be doing it a disservice to try to go through it and summarize everything. I just encourage you to read the whole thing if you haven't already. And we're going to talk about some of the parts that we find most interesting, if that sounds good to you, Nate.
Yeah, that's good. This book is a forest that grows out of trees, and there's no point in trying to just say three things to summarize everything. It's just better to start talking about the book.
Yeah. The one thing that I do want to highlight up front that I think is important in terms of thinking about how to read this book or what to be looking to get out of it, because I do think some people, like I remember Mason Malmuth didn't give it a real good review. I think some people just don't. I mean, it doesn't read like a normal poker book, right? You open it up and you're not going to find equity calculations and charts of what hands to play from what positions and all like the kind of stuff that you're used to seeing in poker books, especially when the book first came out. But even now, it's quite different. I think some people just don't know what to do with it. So I want to highlight, this is from the end of the section about this book on page 7. Tommy says, "This book is about imagining idealistic extremes and then implementing practical methods of moving toward them." And I really think that's something to keep in mind as you're looking through the whole book, that you know, Tommy's talking about an ideal of what would it be like if you could play entirely without tilt? What would it be like if you could just do all these things perfectly all the time? And it's possible to confuse the sort of authorial voice that he uses here as though he is doing all of these things with Tommy Angelo, the person who, in fact, has had a long struggle with tilt that he's talked about a lot. And I don't think he's going to claim that he always does these things perfectly or that you can actually always do these things perfectly. It's more a matter of setting up and like a thought experiment of really thinking through what would it be like to be entirely without tilt. What would it be like if you played as though position were absolutely the most important thing and you were just always tried to act in position? He's kind of deliberately taking these things to extremes to help you think through what they would look like and to imagine them, I guess, as possibilities for yourself rather than just saying, oh, I'm going to try to tilt less the next time I go to play. Like that doesn't mean anything. Like what does that actually look like? What differences does it have for the way you think and the way you behave? I think keeping that in mind as one of the objectives of this book will help you to make sense of some of the more obscure passages or difficult to parse passages.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I'm glad you pointed that out because if that's the structure of this book, imagining what the ideal poker player would be like, then trying to figure out what the path is from the person somebody is now to that player, this actually, in that structure, grows out of a pretty noble tradition. A lot of the great ethical treatises from ancient Greece and beyond took exactly that structure. So it's fun to read this in that tradition. And I think a lot of people just don't get it. If I recall correctly, Mason's review was something like, this is a self-help book with a lot of cute phrases.
Yeah.
As though helping oneself and
detached from poker.
Yeah. as though those are different goals. And I imagine for some people if you do already have it all figured out, like if you're already totally tranquil and nice to everybody all the time and completely not prone to tilting, maybe you don't need a book like this. And if Mason's in that situation, good for him. But for the rest of us, I think, you know, concrete ways to work toward these sort of motivational ideals of playing the best you can and thinking about all the best habits of mind and play that you can have is a useful thing.
Yeah, this book has really made big differences in terms of the way that I behave when I'm at the poker table. I guess getting the sense that like you don't have to respond to things that are happening. Like just because someone says something to you doesn't mean that you have to either respond by saying something back to them. Like, you know, if someone says something snotty about the way you played a hand or about the fact that you just sat down on them, like you're not obligated to say anything at all. Like you can literally just ignore them. Pretend they didn't say anything, or you can just say sorry and not mean it, or there's no need for you to try to like one-up them, or and it's detrimental to you to do this. As much as you might think, and you hear this justification of like, oh, I was trying to get under his skin, I think it's actually very, very difficult, even if you think that you're entering it entirely from a strategic point of view. Like, oh, I'm going to get into a thing with this guy and I'm not going to get emotionally involved in it. I'm just going to be feigning emotional involvement in order to get him all riled up. I think that's actually extremely difficult to do. I think it's likely once you do get into a back and forth with somebody, because I mean, I think of myself as someone who's not easily flustered, but it does happen to me. Like, if I actually allow myself to get into a back and forth with someone, it will affect the way I play against that player. But like, you don't have to respond to them at all. Like, you can just let them be upset. You can let them say things. You can let them think what they think. You can let them sit there and whisper with the person next to them at the table, and you know damn well that they're talking about you. And it doesn't matter. Like, it's fine for them to do all those things. In fact, they're giving away information to you about how they're going to play against you, how they're thinking about the game. Looking at it as an opportunity rather than as something that you have to respond to because of some like caveman bravado that you have, where you're like, yeah, fuck me, no, fuck you. Like, you don't need to get into that. You can just let them do that, and you also don't have to have an emotional response. Like, even if you don't say anything, you don't have to get upset about it. You can just acknowledge, like, this is a thing that's happening right now. That man is upset that he just lost a pot to me, and you don't have to. Even if you say nothing, and I think saying nothing is the way to start, even if you are feeling something, to say nothing, I think that can actually serve to de-intensify or de-escalate what you're feeling. But you don't have to have an emotional response to it either. You don't have to say, I'm angry at this guy that he's sitting there, you know, fuming and talking about how bad I'm playing with the guy next to him. You can just acknowledge that it's happening without feeling one thing or telling yourself anything about it one way or the other.
Yeah, or you can have the emotional response without acting on it and without saying anything at the table. I mean, it's not, you know, this apatheia that he recommends is not necessarily something that all of us want to aspire to, but we all can aspire to this sort of nonviolence at the table where we don't yell at each other and we don't get angry for bad reasons. And
likewise, you know, you don't have to respond to things that happen at the table. When you take a bad beat, you don't have to act frustrated. You don't have to tell people about it. You don't have to continue to think about it yourself. It can just be a thing that happened. You suck out on somebody. Yeah. You don't have to apologize to them. You don't have to explain why you made the play that you made. You don't have to tell them, oh, I was priced in or I had to call. Like, you don't have to say anything. You can just let the pot happen. Let the chips get pushed where they're supposed to get pushed. If a dealer makes a mistake, you can correct it without having any kind of emotional response to it, or you can even just let it slide. I mean, it's not the end. It truly is not the end of the world if you're sure that so and so didn't ante, but the dealer insists that he did, and that you're the one who owes the ante. Like, in the end, it's really just an ante chip. Like, a lot of the things that people get really upset about, I'm not saying dealer errors never matter, but I mean, a lot of the things that people want to correct dealers on, it's even if those things don't end up getting corrected. Like, if you point out that something is being done wrong and they don't do anything about it, you don't have to get huffy about it and just decide, oh, this guy's terrible, call the floor. Like, you can just let it go and let a small mistake occur.
Yeah, that's right. And I also like the flip side of this coin. We've been talking about how this book can help you realize that things that you would react to are things that you in fact shouldn't react to in a way. But for me, I think it's almost been more helpful to recognize that all these things that used to feel natural and okay and acceptable are in fact often not okay and not acceptable. So even an innocuous seeming thought like, I'm stuck $1,000 and I would like to get even. It's like, well, why do I want to get even? Why do I expect that I'm going to win $1,000 in a 2-5 game? Isn't that a lot of hours of my win rate? And how much money have I won at poker in my life? You know, like, why is there this baseline that I'm thinking about, which is the amount of money I had in my pocket before I showed up at the casino tonight? You know, if the right cards fall my way, shouldn't I be hoping to win more than $1,000 between now and the end of the night? And in all these things. And I actually think it's an old Mike Caro-ism that Tommy sort of perfected and took to a much higher level. You know, Mike Caro used to say, don't try to get even. You already are even. Which is perfectly true. The best baseline number you have is the total number of dollars you have right now, not the number you had, you know, 2 hours ago or 1 year ago or whatever. I mean, you're even. However much money you have right now, you are even. And yeah, so all these things, I think, you know, even setting chip goals in a tournament, this is something that a lot of people do. And it seems very natural to a lot of people. And it's it's destructive. Yeah, it's a well, it's more than that. It's a destructive habit of mind, I think. It
you know, trying to get up to 20,000 by, well, I guess you start with 30,000.
Yeah, I mean, people say stuff like, well, my goal is to finish every level with 100 big blinds or something. And like, how does that change your behavior? Like, I have 90 big blinds or 200 big blinds, my objective is win as many chips as I can every hand. Like, there's nothing I'm going to do differently. Yeah. I'm not going to like pass up a good steal spot because I have more than 100 big blinds. I'm not going to like raise in a bad steal spot because I have fewer than 100 big blinds and I want to like try to get there or go bust. Like, that would just be a mistake.
Yeah, well, I think you bring it out nicely. It's a negative free roll. That's the best case. The best case is that you're saying something completely meaningless and unactionable. Anything else is that you actually do condition behavior on those little goals you set for yourself, which is to make a mistake.
Or in the case of getting even, I guess the mistake is continuing to play when you shouldn't. Like, you're tired, you're frustrated, the game is no longer good, and you would quit if you were up because you're down. You're like, well, I'm going to stay until I get even, even though like your prospects, even if you're still plus EV, like it might be more plus EV to just like get some sleep and come back and play again the next day when the game is better, even though it means taking a quote loss on the night. Like,
and if you're like most people, nobody underestimates his expectation in that situation. So if it's close, just go get yourself a, you know, a beer or ginger ale or whatever your drink of choice is, unless you're driving. And
one of the beautiful things about this book is that it, in a lot of cases, he's telling you things that you already sort of know to be true, or as you point out, that other people have said similar things before, but he says them in ways that make you take them seriously. You know, he kind of like breaks them down and gives you sort of the irrefutable logic behind it, and also just puts them very simply. So like, I like this passage on page 27, where he's talking about this idea of A game and B game and C game. A game being like the best poker that you're capable of playing, which is what most poker books and training materials and things, they focus on improving your A game when you're already playing your best, helping you just, you know, be even better. And then, you know, Tommy's book mostly focuses on what he calls lopping off the C game. So getting rid of the times when you're not playing at your best. And according to Tommy anyway, even people who are plus EV during their A game are going to be negative EV during their C game, which is like when they're tilted or tired or frustrated or whatever. So he's saying you can actually improve your overall win rate quite a bit if you just spend less time playing during your C game, if you get frustrated less easily, and if you quit when you are frustrated. So Tommy says, all the people who have won lots of money over many years at poker have three things in common. They have an A game that will beat someone else's A game. They play against those people. And they play their A game dang near always. And I mean, poker really is that simple. It's like, you don't have to be good. You just have to be better than people you're playing against. And you have to play against those people. You know, don't play against the people who are better than you. Just find people who are less good than you, play against them, and then, you know, play your best. That's all you have to do to win money.
Yeah. And it's one of the inspiring consequences of this book that win rates, I think, could be much higher than a lot of people think they could be. I know I do a lot of the mistakes that Tommy talks about, yet I still win at poker, so I could be doing much better. I look at winning players at the casino, and I think they're all making some of these mistakes, but they still win. And, you know, there are just so many ways of going wrong psychologically. You know, there are so many ways to be self-deceived or lazy or uncareful, and there are just so many mistakes to make that almost everybody makes at least some of. You know, imagine how good you could be if you made just some,
or just how much money you would have if you had never made, like, if you could go back and erase all the times that you played when you were frustrated or anything else, all those times when all the mistakes that you made because of things related to playing in your C game, if you could just erase all of those from your poker history, you know, you would I at least would be a good deal better off, and I think I've probably tilted a lot less than the average poker player.
Me too, on both counts. I mean, that is something that I think fits other data. I mean, this is, I guess, just a side thesis of mine, but I do think that we sometimes underestimate win rates. If you look at the win rates of the best players, like, or just like the rate of making final tables of the best players, I know that there's a selection bias there, but even after we figured out that Phil Ivey and Vanessa Selbst and so on were good, you know, Phil still made, what, 5 final tables last World Series or something like that. And I think this goes, and this also gets back to, you know, Sylvain's hand that we talked about. I mean, as far as I can tell, he's a good player and he was playing fine, but I think his flop bet was just this huge mistake. And I think a player like Justin is going to exploit that really, really well. And, you know, imagine if you picked up on it every time somebody did that, you know, like there are just so many more mistakes happening at the poker table than we all think there are, I think.
So another cool thing that I like in the book is this general idea that the quitting, which is a big part of lopping off your C game, and really the two elements of playing in your C game less often are not getting frustrated in the first place, like not going into C game or not being as prone to slip into C game play. And then secondarily, recognizing when you're in your C game or you're about to be in your C game and quitting at those times so that you don't play while you're frustrated. And I really like the emphasis that Tommy puts on quitting being a skill in and of itself. Like, quitting is something that you can do well. It's a really important element of your game. You know, like knowing, stopping at the right time is really important to your win rate. I mean, that's a big way of, we were just saying, if you could get rid of all those mistakes that you ever made in your poker career, quitting at the right time is a good way to get rid of those mistakes. So it's really important, and it's a skill, just like value betting or three betting or hand reading or anything, any other poker skill. Like, quitting is a skill, and it's something that can be practiced. And Tommy really talks about that quite literally, of like practicing quitting. And this is something that I've advised to one or two of my students who have issues with tilt or with quitting. Is, you know, I told this guy, and he lives like 40 minutes away from the casino that he plays in, and I said, drive over to the casino, sit down, play one orbit, and no matter what happens, whether you lose, whether you win, whatever, play one orbit, and when it's backed around to you on the big blind, get up, cash out, and drive back home. Practice quitting.
How'd that go?
I mean, he said he thought it was helpful.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. So do you want to talk about places where we might disagree with Tommy in this first section? So there's one about bankroll and moving up, and this could just be other stuff I know about Tommy and a little bit less what's in this book. And I think Joe Tall has a story that he's told about how he got coaching from Tommy way back in the day. And Tommy said, Joe, would you become more comfortable at the table if you had twice the bankroll that you had now? Joe said, yes. Tommy said, okay, then double your bankroll requirements. And that was it. That was the end of it. And as with all things, I think playing in a state where you're not worried at all about money is a good thing, but I'm not sure if it isn't worth putting a little bit of financial stress on yourself if your expected earn is much greater. I mean, of course, playing with money you can't afford to lose is never okay. I'm not talking about that kind of financial strain, but let's say you have an $11,000 bankroll and there's a good 2-5 game at your casino. You know, 22 buy-ins is not a huge amount of money, but if that's your poker bankroll and you can afford to lose it, even though losing a $1,000 pot will probably hurt a little bit in that case, it's not clear to me that you're making a mistake by playing that game. I mean, you should maybe try to cultivate a state where losing won't hurt, but I don't think it's quite as absolute as Tommy makes it out to be. And this could be a case where the laying out the ideal sounds a little bit more like something you're supposed to go implement.
Yeah, that was kind of going to be my answer to you, is that, I mean, if we think of this as a book that's about idealistic extremes, then, you know, Tommy's really just giving you the advice of, like, if you want to never tilt, have a bigger bankroll. And I mean, I guess it becomes a matter for you of to what extent the financial pressure is, you know, when it comes to actually implementing these ideas, you need to decide, like, to what extent is the financial pressure contributing to tilt, contributing to me playing less well? Because, I mean, you hear from pretty much every person who's played nosebleed stakes, certainly the like younger internet kids who have like come up quickly through stakes, as opposed to like a Doyle Brunson or someone who just had like a lifetime to grind out a bankroll. You know, pretty much all of them are going to say at some critical juncture they played in games that they were not bankrolled for, and they ran well in those games, and that enabled them to get up a bankroll to play in like nosebleed type stakes. And a lot of people have speculated, and I think there's something to this, that to be able to play poker for hundreds of thousands of dollars, or even for any amount that's going to be significant relative to your bankroll, and to not have that affect you psychologically, requires a certain kind of detachment from results and from money that not all people may be capable of at all, and B, that's easier to have when you are young and single and don't really have the kinds of financial responsibilities that older people and people with families tend to have, where if you're in college or shortly out of college and all of your friends are living on $1,000 a month anyway, then, you know, losing $80,000 when you have $200,000 to your name is not really that big of a deal to you. I mean, it sucks, but it's not the same in the same way that like losing 40% of your net worth as a person with children and a mortgage to pay is a much bigger deal. So I think there are some people who are better capable of being detached from the kinds of financial pressures of playing at the limits of their bankroll or beyond the limits of their bankroll than others are.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I do want to say, well, two things. First, wasn't it kind of awesome last year when Jeans on 2+2 played the $1 million tournament without selling any of himself? I thought that was exciting and interesting. And yeah, it's at Jens something, Jeans on 2+2. It had something to do with Scandinavian tax law. I can't remember which country. I think he's Finnish. So I guess Finnish tax law in that case, where losing $1 million was like losing much less than $1 million to him because of the taxes. So he played the one drop and he didn't sell any of his action. And I did verify this with somebody who was definitely Facebook friends with him and appeared to be an actual friend of him and was Finnish. So I got this. This is not just an internet rumor. It's coming from a random person I was playing with at the Rio during World Series time. And you never hear any bullshit at those tables during the World Series. So I don't know if awesome is the right word, but it strikes me that that's something that at my time of life I will never do, I don't think. Not that I have anywhere near $1 million in my poker bankroll, but yeah, I think that's something for young single Scandinavians. Yeah, and thing two, I think it's right that it is some kind of an ideal to play with no financial stress, but the quitting, that we have to remember that there are different kinds of ideals. So I think the quitting ideal is difficult, but it's something that you actually ought to do. If you think you're not playing your A game and you ought to just come back to the table tomorrow, you should get up and leave. Whether or not you can right now and whether or not, you know, that's something that a lot of people can do, it's the sort of ideal that you should actually work toward, and it would be better for you if you did it. The money goal, like if you have $11,000 and playing 2-5 will hurt a little bit, the ideal situation is for that not to hurt at all, either because you know you're making the right decision so much that the loss won't hurt, or because you have more than $11,000. But it just doesn't follow from that that you ought to stop playing.
It's going to take a long time to grind up another $9,000 at 1-3 if you decide your requirement is going to be $20,000 to play 2-5.
And it seems to me that even that's a case where you don't react to the ideal by just sort of doing what the ideal person would do in a certain way, namely by having the bankroll that's really big for the stakes, and in this case, dropping down to 1-3.
I also had, I don't know if this is quite a disagreement as much as he's not real clear in terms of what he means when there's this conversation about respect that starts on page 45. And later he's kind of talking about respect in the sense of respecting the game and not doing things that are going to interfere with the action. Like if you're sure you're going to fold, but it's a multi-way pot, like don't give any indication that you're going to fold until the action is on you. Like he's kind of talking about that sort of respect, but it's not clear to me in this earlier passage on page 45 that that's exactly what he means by respect. And so he's talking about why people play poker, and he says some people are playing for competition or money, and some people sort of want to be respected. And actually on page 44, he does list wanting to be respected as a very good player as one reason that people give. So I think that's kind of a questionable goal to want to be respected, especially to want to be respected by the people that you're playing with. I think that to some extent, I mean, it can happen that people will recognize that you're doing a lot of things that they're not doing and be like, oh, wow, you're really good. There are other times when they're going to look at it and be like, oh, you're playing junk hands. And like not understanding that it could be correct to play junk hands when you have 8 big blinds and you're on the button. Like, so I don't know that you necessarily want to aspire to be recognized as a good player by the people that you're playing with. Both A, because you know, ideally they don't know what a good player looks like. That's why you're playing with them. Like, they have ideas about what good poker is that are not correct. And you are not necessarily looking to educate them, nor are you looking for approval within the context of those ideas. I mean, you don't want to be playing in the same way as the people you're playing against. You want to be playing better than they are, which means probably playing in ways that they think are not correct, but that you believe are profitable. So I don't know, A, that you should be aspiring for their respect in that regard, and B, I don't know that it's really good for your bottom line to be perceived as a really good player. It may be more difficult for you to get action, or people may play more cautiously against you if you're perceived as being a very good player. So I also think, like, practically, I mean, because Tommy doesn't really dispute that you should be looking for respect. So I don't think it's clear, for instance, that respect earns more money or that playing well necessarily earns respect.
Yeah, I do like some of the stuff he says about respecting the game and respecting.
Oh, yeah, I like that part a lot.
Yeah, and I think it's good because, I mean, for a lot of reasons. I also see where you're coming from here.
Yeah, I do want to highlight one concept that I think is super important. And Tommy introduces it kind of late in the book for being what I consider really central to pretty much all of Tommy's thinking about poker and ways that he suggests for people to get better. I think this was Tommy's article on this concept of reciprocality was maybe the very first thing of his that I ever read, and it was really eye-opening for me. So I really recommend you can just find this essay on reciprocality on Tommy's website, even if you're not reading this whole book. I understand this idea that you in poker, your profit comes from things you do that your opponents don't. Your profit does not necessarily come from winning pots, right? It doesn't come from times when you have aces and the other guy has kings. Because over the long term, like, there's going to be some times when he has aces and you have kings also. Like, those kinds of spots balance out. So it's not just about winning big pots. It's not about winning big pots when you have big hands. It's about winning money or not losing money in cases where your opponents would have won less money or lost more money. It's about, assuming over the course of long poker careers, you're going to be on both sides of or every side of all these different scenarios that come up. How well are you going to play when you're on the winning side? How are you going to play when you're on the losing side relative to what your opponents are doing? I mean, you have to be doing things that they aren't doing in order to win money. It's not just about sitting around waiting for good cards to come to you, which in some way is not really an eye-opening concept. I mean, I imagine most people get that in some regard, but I think his essay does a really good job of breaking that down. And in particular, I think he has a good example on page 61 that explains this well. He says, let's say that Joe and Mo both hit the flop. At some point in the hand, they get all in. In reality, Joe busts Mo. In reciprocality, the main question is, would Mo have busted Joe? If the answer is yes, then the hand is a tie. If the answer is no, then Joe wins the hand by however much money he has in front of him at the end of the hand in the imagined reality. In other words, if we reverse the situations and we say, you know, the guy who, in this case, busted the other player, now we're going to put him on the losing end, does he also lose his ass? You know, and if the answer is yes, then it's just a cooler situation. It's a spot where neither of you would have gotten away from it. And in reality, you got lucky that you were on the winning end of it, but you haven't really done anything that your opponent wouldn't have done. You just had lucky cards. You were in a lucky situation. If you were on the losing side and you managed to not lose all of your money, you saved some money in a circumstance where your opponent would have lost all of his money, then that's a spot where you're really profiting in theory.
Truth. Yeah, my favorite Dan Harringtonism of all time is that his edge over another player is greatest when they're both losing.
Yeah, I didn't
know. Yeah, just awesome. And I also, while you were brilliantly summarizing that bit, I Googled reciprocality. And the article is on the first page. So really all you have to do is Google reciprocality and it'll be right there.
That's what I would consider, what we would consider the critical elements from this section of Elements of Poker. Again, there's a lot that we didn't even touch on. I mean, there's a ton of these short little 1, 2, 3 paragraph long statements, a lot of which are insightful and different ones might resonate with different people. So these aren't even necessarily the most important parts of this section, but they're the parts that struck Nate and me the most, or ones that we thought could most benefit from elucidation. I'm actually going to have, by the time this you hear this podcast, you should be able to find this article as well in 2+2 magazine, the April edition. I'll put a link in the show notes as well, but I wrote an article for the magazine unpacking this concept of the idealistic extreme that we started off this segment talking about. I talk about that in more detail and apply it to some other things in poker besides just Tilt and Tommy Angelo's writing on Tilt. So if you're interested in that concept, I'll have a link up to that article as well, and you can read a bit more of my thoughts on that subject. For next week, we are going to be reading parts 2 through 5, which is page 85 through page 174, if you're reading in an old-fashioned paper book. We're happy to answer comments on part 1 as well, so if you're still catching up, you can send those questions to podcast@thinkingpoker.net, or you can tweet at Thinking Poker. You can leave them as blog comments as well. Basically, if you find a way to put the question in front of our eyes, then we will talk to you.
Yeah, tweet at Nate Mavis. Now we're ready to get back.
Taco Bell tonight, babe. Anything.